Thank you very much, Sienna. Now, I understand you're a bit challenged with a microphone. So if down either end, down in the bleachers, if you can't hear me, would you just start waving and I'll make sure I move in a little bit. Well, thank you very much for that lovely welcome and happy International Women's Day to all sisters and their supporters. It was a very generous welcome, Sienna, and recounting my CV will no doubt tell you that I'm incapable of saying no and have been leaning in so far that I'm almost falling over. But I do want to start by thanking Rotary for your extraordinary work and your commitment to service of the community and particularly those who are most vulnerable. It is an inspiring role that you play, each of you in your individual lives, but together the possibility of the work of Rotary and the difference it can make in the world is quite remarkable. Can I also begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional owners of the country that we meet on and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Now the theme for this International Women's Day is Press for Progress. So how are we going? The last few months have been both energising and perplexing in terms of our treatment of women and the new energy of women's voices. Events in Canberra, particularly over the last few weeks, have been nothing short of astonishing. As one writer for Women's Agenda said recently, the former Deputy Prime Minister's latest shaming of his girlfriend and her unborn child was, no pun intended, inconceivable. The former Minister for Women spectacularly misfired in an apparent attempt to pursue a negative campaign against the Leader of the Opposition, presumably on instructions, by dragging staff into it. So what were they thinking? I fear the answer is they are not, and I fear that what is missing is common courtesy that we used to be so proud of in our everyday discourse. I did learn something incredibly useful from the former Minister for Women, Michaela Cash, that I'd like to share with you. I was dutifully summoned to hear an announcement by the government that it was reversing impending cuts to legal services for women, including those affected by domestic violence. And she taught me how to pose for a good photo, so I'm going to share it with you because this is an invaluable lesson and you must all give it a go. It's newly acquired by me, so I don't pretend to have it exactly right, but after observing the very glamorous former Minister for Women working the camera, let me show you. Michaela demonstrated that if one stands like this, with one's hip turned this way, and chest turned this way, and one's arm out like this, one could present the perfect silhouette to the cameras. One then needs to extend one's neck like this, like a tortoise, and drop one's chin like this, and then look up. And apparently this will create the perfect photo opportunity, and I'm now going to give the entire speech like this. But you probably already know all these things, so I'm going to immediately give up the pose. In any case, please let your lives, or what is remaining of them, be about posing for photos, the accumulation of stuff, the recycling of CVs and impressive sounding titles, because our lives are much more than this, and that would be a waste of those precious lives. We need to acknowledge that individually and collectively, we are some of the most powerful people and most privileged human beings on the planet, now and at any time in our history. And the world is really individually and collectively open to all of you. So today, in the glow of this extraordinary company, including, I'm very pleased to see our raffle prize winner and Ken, who I previously worked with so many years ago, it's time to reflect on those everyday opportunities that we have to make a difference and to reflect on where we are and what matters to us. It is often those small everyday opportunities that can create an enormous ripple effect and a world of good. An extraordinary series of those small opportunities led me to acting for a young woman who'd been trafficked to Australia as a 13-year-old child to work in a brothel in Sydney. The story touched me, as sometimes these stories get behind our shield, because at the time I had a 13-year-old daughter. My eldest daughter was 13. When I heard about her situation and heard about the terrible abuse she'd suffered while she was in this brothel. And I was moved to offer her assistance and we ended up achieving the first victims of crime compensation claim for her as a person trafficked into Australia. A couple of years ago, I stood in a Darwin courtroom during a Royal Commission and listened as elderly men and women described their broken lives. These were not lives they had been particularly proud of having lived, since they'd been horribly abused as children in state care, removed from their parents under well-intended removal policies of the government at the time. A short while ago, the civil claims of those people were resolved. Last year, I stood on the steps of Parliament House in Canberra with Indigenous leaders as they called for a new collaborative approach to addressing entrenched disadvantage of our First Peoples. And a month later, I stood in a Royal Commission appearing for government officials who were describing the steps they were taking to ensure children in detention were protected from abuse. Now, none of this was in my wildest imagination when I started my law degree or started my life as a barrister working away in commercial law. I really had no sense that while the law protects, sometimes it also fails to protect those most in need of just outcomes. And some problems, some issues that confront us demand that we think deeply about our morality, about what is being done in our names, what is acted upon without question, without scrutiny, and without objection. And it urges us to think of those people who are invisible, like the young girl in the brothel. No doubt most of you can think of two or three things immediately that make you angry. You will think about things that you care about deeply and profoundly. Some of those things we know are obvious, like our families, however fragile they may be. But some things we're just not aware of until we're confronted by the injustice or immorality of a situation. My point is that you in this room have tools to do something about these that very few other people on the planet have. You're all intelligent. You know how to find things out. You're interested in issues of public importance and bring yourself along for public engagement. And you're all, I confess I'm assuming here, reasonably articulate. In speaking out against injustice, you're practicing a skill that is vital to our democracy and that shields us from the overreach of potential dictators. Lawyers know this instinctively. I don't know how many of you are lawyers in the room, but we understand that cases, individual cases, protect the rule of law one case at a time by defending the independence of the courts, testing the boundary of executive power, and by building careful, respectful arguments founded upon testable propositions. Our democracy and our strength is not found in fear or anger, in tweets or the shouting of slogans. So I would urge you, if you see something you're uncomfortable about, ask questions. And if the answer is that we've always done things this way, ask why and point to the injustice. If you see something that is wrong or hurtful, speak out. Because if you do not, we will see more of the same. As we approach the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, actually it was the end of last year if we calculate correctly, it's timely to ask how far we've progressed in realising the assumptions and the aspirations of that time. How far have we secured fundamental human rights in the dignity and worth of the human person and the equal rights of men and women? Now, back in 1948, when the Universal Declaration was proclaimed and everybody signed on with enthusiasm, We were emerging from World War II. Women had ably stepped in during the war to fill all manner of professional and trade roles. But after the war, the culture shifted away from women's advancement and prosperity to secure those fragile goals of global peace and restoration. The world was reeling in the face of unspeakable atrocities, the maiming, slaughter and displacement of millions of lives, and the destructive impact of weapons of mass destruction. And so women stepped back, as they often do. They took off their overalls to comfort and heal the shattered men. They put on their aprons, and in doing so, we relinquished the opportunity to cement our place as natural and equal partners in leadership. And now, more than a century after universal suffrage in Australia, we are still waiting for the promise of the Universal Declaration to be fulfilled. Occasionally, we are judges and governors and politicians, even prime ministers. But our numbers lag well behind. We have achieved some firsts in public life, increasingly participating in decision making, but we are well off the groundswell needed to sustain our representation at senior levels. And the conversation I hear, at least around the bar, is give it up, you've got equality, move on. Now, we can continue to press for transformation of our own patch, our own workplaces, making incremental gains. But if we do so in a society that assumes women's voices are weaker, then we have a fundamental problem. We're still being told by men and by women that we're being precious or overreacting to bad behaviour, that we need to man up to get ahead. We're still undermined for shining a light on unfairness and told we're only doing so because we're no good at it and want an unfair advantage. And I can offer some examples close to home. Over my time at the bar of nearly 24 years, I have personally experienced the exclusion from head table despite holding preeminent leadership roles, the drunken, uninvited groping at dinners, sleazy suggestive remarks and put-downs, direct attempts at intimidation inside and outside the courtroom, and those pernicious sexist put-downs and banter dressed up as good humour that demeans women and eats away at our confidence like the dripping of water on a stone. So what is our aspiration and what do we want it to look like? Well, we want it to be fair. We want a working environment for all women that fosters and rewards individual application, ability, integrity, shielded from discriminatory pay and practices. So what do we need to do to get there? We truly have it better than most, and for most, I suspect, in this room of those higher-powered women, our challenges are getting enough sleep, nurturing our close personal relationships, or finding deep pockets so that we can outsource the rest of our lives. We need to have attention to our whole needs, including our health and well-being. And we need recruitment, promotion, the procurement of subcontractors and selection of project partners that is free from bias. We need to chip away at the underlying bias in our culture that reinforces our perception that women are, in fact, less capable at most things. Now, most of you have heard of the phenomenon of unconscious bias, or the variety of biases that operate as neurological phenomenon. Most of these are unconscious phenomenon that have been developed in our brains, our very clever human brains, over the generations. Our brains process millions of pieces of information every second. And the minute you walked into this room, you unconsciously recognised any observable difference in racial appearance from yourself in a 1/150th of a second. In 1/120th of a second, you then noticed the gender of everyone in your line of sight. You then noticed any unusual age or physical characteristics of those present. Now, this is not a criticism. It's a survival trait that helped us survive in the wild, most likely. We all do it. Our impulsive neurological processing has helped us survive and succeed as a species. But the problem is, we notice those things, it's when we act on them as though they were valid judgments about people's abilities that we get ourselves into strife. When we're unaware of those biases and act on the inherent assumption about capabilities in recruiting people, in offering them difficult work projects, in the promotion, the opportunities for the next case or the next client, we are making poor business decisions. Now, women, non-Anglo-Europeans, gays, those with disabilities, and others know all about this effect. And for some, there are numerous factors at play. But if we want to go beyond unconscious bias to consider diversity as a value in itself, we're then said to be choosing other than on merit or resorting to tokenism. And the absence of women in leadership roles, of course, perpetuates or confirms the validity of these biases. In a significant class action I was running in Melbourne a few years ago, the Murrindindi bushfire class action, representing thousands of individual claimants, we had not one single expert witness across a huge range of scientific and engineering disciplines as a woman. The last time I saw a female expert scientific witness in court was years ago. I think she was a town planner or perhaps an obstetrician. But remark to yourself, when did you last see women take up more than a single article on a single page of the sports pages in the papers or anywhere in the business pages? Last year, I did a bit of a survey on International Women's Day, so this is a year old, forgive me, but I undertook an exercise worth a few minutes of your time. I checked the papers. In that morning's Australian newspaper, there were no images of women at all, and only one, Gina Reinhart, in the business section. There were none at all in the legal section. In fact, there were more cows in the entire back section of the paper than women. In The Age, there was only one image of a woman, the Vixens, in six pages of sports. Now, I thought there was another one, but it turned out to be a socceroo with a man bun. We just don't see women. Women who do stand up to have fleeting recognition, then are cut down, and their physical attributes are attacked, their contribution to public life is diminished, especially as they age. It now seems normal. Think about our heroes, our national icons, immortalised in the endless conversation we seem to be having about values. Who are they? Who are our mythological heroes? The digger in his slouch hat and uniform with shining badges, defending the weak with force of arms, undoubtedly. The glorious strength of the young footy player. Even perhaps the laconic joker entertaining mates over the barbecue with a few beers. The marketing experts understand this mythology all too well. But apart from some nominally and transitionally heroic women or imaginary superwomen with capes and superpowers, our heroes are nearly all male, and in many instances, their sexual prowess and physical aggression is condoned and even glorified. This aggression translates into men's own expectations about how they should be men, how they should relate to us and to each other. So we must identify and address bias and consider how best to encourage real action on this issue. As Elizabeth Broderick said, we need to see women in leadership roles. You can't be what you can't see. And of course, leaders, when leaders speak rationally and with authority, they're heard. We need them and we need you to state the business case, to direct policy developments and commitments, to identify and nurture the next cohort, to persuade others that it actually costs in terms of morale, productivity, human capital, the cost of retraining, lost investment, to lose women from the workplace. And we need leaders to reward effective behaviour, to insist on transparency of criteria for advancement and the allocation of work. We need our next generation of leaders to know that they will be judged suitable for promotion when they demonstrate a commitment to diversity. And we definitely need to see large numbers of women leading, not one-off prime ministers, but large numbers. When those leaders do speak out, we, all of us, need to thank them with a multitude of voices so they know they're not alone and not undermined by the pernicious sniping. For those of us pressing the agenda, it's sometimes been difficult, perplexing, and even humiliating to be told we're only complaining because we're no good at it. We go hell for leather and impatient at the pace of change, worn out by the effort and lack of progress. But who does not, in this room, want the same opportunity for their daughters as are available to their sons? We need institutional change, generational change, and change that sticks. Change that is not dependent on the odd leader popping up and being supported. Now, we want to be counted as capable, hardworking, clever, talented advocates and lawyers, in my case, who are women, not as handmaidens who had to adopt male stereotypes to succeed. We want work to be a place we come to wanting to be there and not continue looking over our shoulders for the sexist put down or innuendo or afraid of far worse. And I invite you to consider that the reason it has been so hard is because at base, women are not valued as men are, that our social and economic standing reflects a deeply entrenched view that girls are less worthy. And our privileged view can sometimes mask the grinding reality for other women in society. Those pay differentials that translate into lifelong insecurity and dependency for many. Women in our society and around the world experience violence and abuse in confounding numbers and are increasingly at risk of homelessness, incarceration, mental illness and isolation. Women continue to be impoverished, prostituted, trafficked, abducted, idealised, assaulted, exploited and murdered in the home, at work, in the public and here and overseas. We are swamped by images of women's bodies selling things, de-identified, disembodied, objectified, pornographised, ever younger and thinner, photoshopped beyond any resemblance to real faces and real bodies in the fulfilment of an endless appetite for sexual fulfilment. We expect women in the public eye to be thin and young and then criticise them for being so. We join in the chorus of criticism with each other's appearances. We put up with vile marketing humour, with a thin veneer of violence sells things to men who are encouraged to enjoy or turn a blind eye. And we sexualise our girls way too young. I suspect we've become so overwhelmed and inured to stories of abuse, with such low expectations of the treatment of women and children here and overseas, that we barely register the treatment as abuse until it touches someone we love. Think for a moment how we vanish our elder women and condone the silencing of their voices and diminishing of their sexuality. Think how we cut down women who succeed. Now, the solutions for these issues are complex, but certainly within our grasp with will and creativity. At the core, we need to expose and reframe our deep-held beliefs about girls and women's worth in society, and to celebrate that feisty, boisterous nature of girls, to encourage them to express themselves and their needs and their dreams fully and frankly as we do our boys. To resist the temptation to idealise and sexualise them, and to observe and record the points along the way at which being like a girl diminishes us rather than celebrates us. What would the world look like if those girls and women of 1948 had followed the path promised by the Universal Declaration over the last 70 years? If they were truly free, truly empowered to participate in society, fed, educated, housed, employed, and employing others, respected, appreciated, expressing themselves freely, leading our institutions and our communities. We have been there at a tipping point, and we can be there again. And we need tools to sell the message that equality is an idea whose time has come, to harness those with a proven track record of creating and entrenching organisational change. We need to pull the collective wisdom of the fireplace, where lessons are learned in stories told in the leaping flames, accepting that this problem is so big that we need all of us to solve it. And we need to take our stories and collaborate with those who speak directly through pictures, music, and simple messages to millions. We need to be swamped with images of everyday success, not just the superwomen prime ministers, governors, and chief justices, but mums working at home and fathers working from home, making lunches, braiding their daughters' hair for school. We need to see young women without makeup, studying science, working with power tools, surfing, women leading meetings, giving expert evidence in court, women pilots, engineers, firefighters, soldiers and miners. We need to see women doing it full-time and part-time, leading teams and firms and cases on the bench and off to make a new normal. Normal women juggling and coping alongside men who are also juggling and coping. And we need to back each other up. So when the question of promotion or advancement or appointment comes up and someone says, well, she's not really ready, well, she's not really that good, there is a chorus of voices saying, yes, she is. So to each of you in this room, one of the most privileged, best educated persons on the planet, this is a great trust, and I ask you to join in it with me. It is a trust to be held on behalf of the future women and for the future. So I want to ask you a few things before I finish, for the years ahead. In issues of diversity and equality, be authentic with each other and with others. Be wary of groupthink. Diversity is to be cherished and valued. And to the women in the room, be brave for the goals you set for yourself and walk tall through life unashamed of those goals. I ask all of you to use your voices in defence of those who are powerless and those who are vulnerable, to point out injustice when you see it, because there is nothing more satisfying than using your learning and your training in the service of others. And finally, I want you to take up the opportunity to remind a young woman that when she walks into the room, she has the capacity to light up that room, because they are all extraordinary. Thank you.